This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to Go Home in a Box, your podcast source for deep discussion of genre films, where we change things up just a little bit starting this week. Starting with this very episode, we'll take a look at two films, dissect them, analyze them, praise them, poke holes in them, burn them or bury them. However, one thing hasn't changed. We still talk about movies that no one else will. I am one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan, and you can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week we review the first big screen appearance of the crew of the Starship Enterprise in Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Oh, how are you still awake?
Well, let me tell you, you'll have to read the review. It's also where you can find the new weekly piece, What Am I Watching This Week?, where I justify my cancellation of Netflix by finding movies on Amazon's instant video service. Movies like Merlin's Shop of Mystical Wonders. Let me ask you a question, Joel. Have you seen Merlin's Shop of Mystical Wonders? You've probably seen
the Mystery Science Theater.
I was going to say, you've probably seen the MST3K episode where they buried it. But this is the actual non-MST3K Rift movie. And let me just say, it is a much more enlightening experience without the riffing, because you can insert your own jokes. But anyway, the second part of that story, the one with the toy monkey, was actually a recut and edited version of a film called The Devil's Gift from 1984. And they edited it to fit it into the plot of Merlin's Shop of Mystical Wonders.
That's always the mark of quality.
Yeah, but, I mean, that made me actually want to see the entire uncut version of The Devil's Gift. And I think I'm going to go on a VHS hunt for this thing. I mean, it was just so gloriously, awesomely horrible that it needs to be seen to be believed. Anyway, so you can find Merlin's Shop of Mystical Wonders on Amazon's video service. One of those little hidden gems that no one talks about, for good reason. Joining me, as always, is a man who has opened his own store, Joel's Shop of Mystical Dry Cleaning. Your pants are miraculously pressed even before you walk into the store, so why even bother going in? He's the Ayatollah of pop cultura, Joel LaPuma.
I feel like that I should be making an ancient Chinese secret joke, but that commercial is probably really racist. And you can find me at Razor Candy at razor-candy.com.
An excellent site, I might add.
And we've got some larger projects in the works. We may be writing about the New Jersey Horror Con that we've been spending the weekend at, including we'll probably have a bit of writing on a couple of Crispin Glover-directed films that you can only view on the festival and convention circuit. What is it? And it is fine. Everything is fine.
That's, yeah, it's quite an interesting topic to cover on the blog there, Joel.
Crispin always is.
We're on the topic of Crispin Glover, that's a great segue into our new releases for this week, Joel. I have no idea how the connection works, but, you know, we'll dig a little bit deeper into that later then. But we've got a couple of new releases to mention. A couple of big ones. And then our retro releases, as usual. Quite a slew of them, too. He's got a big week, big release week coming up this week.
It's the big lead up to Halloween. Not just horror films, but cult films in general that are always the releases are always thick this time of year.
Oh yeah, so this is we're probably going to see a lot more of this in the coming weeks. You know, to lead up into Halloween, and that's good for us because we have plenty to talk about. And let's kick it off though with let's kick it off with a couple of new releases. You know, stuff that just came out recently and. This stuff that follows in line with our, you know, discussion of genre films, and I think an appropriate one to kick it off is the latest Transformers film, The Last Knight, directed by who, Joel?
Is it still Michael Bay? Is he still like directing it, or is he just like in producing mode?
He's at least producing it. I believe this is supposed to be the last one that's going to have his hands on it in some way. That's what I heard, anyway. But
I mean, I would not be surprised if this were the last one. Period. I mean, it's made so much less money than the other sequels. I think Bay did direct this one. The burnout on these films is starting to really set in, even in the overseas market. So will they squeeze out a couple more? It seems incredibly likely, but they might just decide to cut and run while things are good.
Yeah, how far did you make it, Joel? How far did you make it through the series before you tapped out?
I saw the first one in theater, and of course thought it was shit, but I had no idea how much worse it could get, because the first one at least was somewhat intelligible in terms of filmmaking style. I saw the bulk of the second one, and I thought some of the weirdness of it was really kind of engaging, like Transformer Heaven, and I kind of admired the audacity of the film, and actually some of the action sequences were set up fairly well. The John Turturro climbing up the pyramid, trying to coordinate the location of, you know, Devastator for the railgun on the ship offshore to fire properly. It's like that was partly so engaging because it was an action sequence focused on one human being just trying to accomplish something seemingly impossible while nearly dying the entire time. Like, that's interesting. Like, I would love more of that. I mean, I know everyone's there for, like, robots fighting, but, you know, it loses so much of its interest when it's all just CGI'd. I mean, big monsters fighting, whatever genre you're in, they need physical locations to destroy and, like, crumble around them. Like, or else it just doesn't, you don't feel anything.
Yeah, I really tapped out on it after the first one, so I can't go much further than that. Not the first one was okay. I've seen parts of the second one, and just the Michael Bay's just nonstop action scenes just tend to burn me out. I love action, but too much of it, and the way Bay films it and edits it, you know, a lot of slow-mo and things like that. It's too much for the senses, man.
Yeah, I mean, they have severe, like, structural issues. I mean, obviously. I knew something was up when at the end of Transformers 1, when Megatron died, I didn't realize it was Megatron, or was defeated, I'm not sure he even officially died in that. I thought it was Starscream and didn't realize I was wondering where Megatron was. Because unfortunately, trying to make the Transformers realistic means you have a bunch of jagged metal shapes that are kind of indefinable.
Yeah.
I think the only reason Bumblebee got used so much is you can actually tell which one he is.
He's yellow.
Yeah. That's his character. He's yellow.
So, Transformers The Last Knight out on Blu-ray and DVD this week. Let's jump to another one. New release. Brand new. 47 Meters Down. Yet another take on the Killer Shark movie here, Joel.
I have very mixed feelings about, and I haven't seen 47 Meters Down, nor did I see The Shallows. I mean, 47 Meters Down seems a bit more, it's more an isolation kind of thriller, and the sharks are just kind of there as a plot, as just another obstacle. Yeah. I mean, the fact that they're like,
it's kind of like open water, except it's underwater.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that they're underneath, like, you know, so far down on the ocean floor is the big obstacle. But I have, this is where my tree-hugging side comes out. I have really mixed feelings about doing a serious killer shark movie in, like, 2017, when sharks are so endangered.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's probably, it's probably for the best, because, you know, since Jaws, of course, in the last 40 years since then, there's just been so many takes on this genre, you know, the killer animal. And just sensitivities are at a point where it's kind of hard to justify, you know, man taking on a wild beast without it ending in the death of, I guess, said wild beast.
I think the only proper killer shark movie left to do is an adaptation of the old British Hookjaw comic, where the shark is killing polluters and, you know, smugglers, all Captain Planet style.
Yeah, and instead we're just going to get Sharknado 6 next year.
Yeah, I mean, Sharknado, it's just, like, obviously it's, I don't mind ridiculous ones like that, because it's not like someone's going to watch Sharknado and think, oh, we have to kill great white sharks or they're going to kill us. Like, they're also not thinking we have to kill tornadoes before they kill us. I mean, 47 Meters Down was a pretty big, not like a big hit, but I mean, it had a budget of something like $5 or $6 million and grossed like 10 times that, which, I mean, you know, I have a certain respect for doing like a low budget film like that, getting it into like mainstream theater is a pretty good release, and just like making back 10 times your minuscule budget. Like, I respect that people are still doing that, because so few people are.
Yeah. So, I mean, and the reviews for 47 Meters Down were, the majority of them were good. So it's a good little, shark underwater thriller, if you're so inclined for that sort of thing.
Yeah, and if you ever got, like, candy stuck in your head back in, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, like, seeing Mandy Moore get, like, accosted by sharks is probably a bit cathartic.
In that case, it is, yes. Let's look at a couple of the retro releases coming out this week, Joel, since that's where the money is. We'll start with Shout Factory. Our good old friends at Shout Factory. They're coming out with a couple of releases this coming week. One is the anthology horror film from 1989, After Midnight. And they'll follow that up, of course, with a Blu-ray release of Sgt. Pepper and his Lonely Hearts Club Band. So, yeah, any thoughts on either one here, Joel?
I mean, Sgt. Pepper is one of the bad films, like, legendary bad films I still have to see, but, you know, if you're interested in, like, disaster movies, I don't think you could do much better than a Blu-ray of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Ooh, you classify that as a disaster film.
After Midnight, I don't know much about, except the cast is pretty interesting, including, I know Pamela Adlon, the voice of Bobby Hill in King of the Hill, is in here. You know, a lot of people you'd recognize from TV or other films. Mark McClure from what was he on, Growing Pains, I think, and he was the fake Crispin Glover in Back to the Future 2 and 3.
Oh yeah, okay.
Oh no, I'm sorry. He was the brother Dave. My mistake. But he was Jimmy Olsen and the original, and the, you know, Richard Donner Superman.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, what, Mar- Helgenberger's in here. A lot of people you'd know from just like around. I don't know much about the making of the film, whether it like with a lot of like weird anthology films, there's always like a question like, was this meant to be, or did they just take a bunch of films that were unfinished and just toss it together Night Train to Terror style?
Yeah, that's always interesting, you know, because the anthology film really is kind of like a lost art, and they used to just make films like this specifically designed for one bigger picture of an anthology film, but there have been cases of unfinished films or recut films being spliced into larger stories, much like Merlin's Shop of Mystical Wonders.
Yeah, nice callback. Yeah, like, you know, there's Night Train to Terror and Nightmares, which was recut episodes of an anthology TV series. That was the one from 83 with Lance Henriksen and Emilio Estevez. This one, I think, seems like it was absolutely made to be this film, which is interesting. And fairly late for that kind of film. I think the only other... this is from 89. I think the only other movie I can think of around that that immediate time frame is From a Whisper to a Scream from 87.
Yeah, okay.
Penelope Sudro for Jennifer, the Welcome to Primetime bitch girl from Dream Warriors is in this, actually.
All right, awesome. So, yeah, a good cast. After Midnight, just FYI, I'm a big fan of the Comet TV channel, and After Midnight's been showing sporadically on that channel as well, so... anyone listening that has access to Comet, you know, check the schedule and check it out because it'll be available on there as well. Moving on to a couple of Vinegar Syndrome releases, Joel. Let's start with this one from 1965. It's Orgy of the Dead.
Oh, this is one I'm very excited about. Orgy of the Dead is an insane Ed Wood penned sort of erotic sort of horror movie, I guess you would call it. I mean, it's literally like the Manos Rocky Horror plot, like a couple wanders into the weirdest and worst situation. I would not be surprised if this was some kind of inspiration on Rocky Horror, because they're literally like wandering into a graveyard and they crash their car and there's an orgy presided by the great Criswell of Plan 9 from Outer Space fame, who's just referred to as the Emperor in this, which makes me really wish for a different Return of the Jedi.
You made that connection to Return of the Jedi, so that's quite awesome.
But this is an Ed Wood screenplay based on an Ed Wood novel. So he didn't direct it. Stephen Apostoloff directed it. I know he did a lot of erotic films, some horror, but I think he was mostly in the proto porn erotic film world. So this is a nice like sleazy little release, and it's got a great pedigree for fans of weirdness and bad movies. Like, it just Ed Wood alone attached to it would be enough, but Criswell being, presiding over this insanity is an absolutely perfect evening.
Yeah, definitely. In the Ed Wood movie, Criswell, that was played by Jeffrey Jones, wasn't it?
Yes. And that has all sorts of unintentional...
Yes, that's why I bring it up. I wanted the unintentional...
just the discomfort of Jeffrey Jones on screen.
What about this one from Vinegar from 1987? Psychos in Love. Because psychos need love, too, you know that.
Well, yeah, of course. This is one I don't know too much about. I know it's literally just like a sort of Bonnie and Clyde-ish lovers on the run kind of film. Like, two serial killers fall in love and do their serial killer thing. It's like a black comedy. I would expect that. It's probably not exactly like things like Society or Parents, but it seems to be in that sort, in that realm. So if you like that,
yeah,
those very ultra weird dark horror comedies, like that's absolutely, it seems like absolutely your thing.
Yeah, it kind of seems like it might be somewhat of a more demented Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, and I know it's been a DVD before, the original release was a Wizard Video one, so I'd imagine that's probably, despite the obscurity of the film, it's probably a kind of a collector's item just because Wizard releases tend to be. So,
yeah. So
I'm curious about this one. I mean, Vinegar, of course, loves to, and they've done a few bigger films, things like Madman, but you know, Dolomite, but you know, their home seems to be with the most like disreputable films, so
yeah, that's why we love them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, here's another one from, I'm not too familiar with the distributor, Tempe Digital, but from 1989, it's the Dead Next Door.
Yeah, and this is one I've been meaning to see for a very long time. You know, it's kind of a dead era zombie film, like, you know, made at a time when people just weren't doing much, like 89. Like, I think I get the only major cult zombie film I can think of around that time is probably, I think, Video Dead was 87 or so.
Yeah.
And if I remember, this had like an extremely low budget, like less than $100,000. Might have been a. Was this one shot on. Shooting?
Yeah, I don't have the notes in front of me for this one, Joel. So, but definitely, the lower the budget, then probably the more. For me, anyway, the more interesting it becomes, because like I've said in the past, you know, the director's creativity tends to come out more when he doesn't have a whole lot to work with.
Oh yeah, and this is very much a one-man show by J.R. Bookwalter, who directed, produced, wrote this, did the music, you know, edited it. Like, it's very much all one. Although I should say that Sam Raimi did serve as the executive producer and helped fund it with some of his proceeds from Evil Dead 2.
His Evil Dead money, yeah.
Yeah. It's Super 8 is what it was shot on.
Okay.
So it's, you know, I spent like 3 or 4 years in production because, you know, this kind of it's sort of a rare case among these very regional, like ultra low budget horror films, like in that its legend actually spread. Like, usually these things come out and maybe there's a bit of a cult following, but that's about it. But, you know, it's been a favorite of zombie fans for a good long time, and from what I understand, the pace is very frenetic. People have called it like an early zombie video game, like I'd imagine like a lot, like doing a zombie film with that kind of speed before that was commonplace was probably the interesting differentiation for people. So yeah, I'm curious to see if it holds up after we've, you know, had 28 Days Later and Snyder's Dawn of the Dead and like big budget fast paced zombie movies. But it really does look like an interesting little moment in zombie films.
Yeah. Excellent, yeah. We have one from Redemption, distributor Redemption. It's a Jess Franco film from the mid-90s, 1996. Killer Barbies.
Jess Franco was still doing stuff in the mid-90s?
Apparently so.
I really got to watch more of his movies.
Yeah, so he had quite some longevity to him there.
Yeah, and oh my God, I think there might be a sequel. Killer Barbies versus Dracula.
Oh my goodness.
So, yeah. It's also known as Vampire Killer Barbies, and the Killer Barbies is a titular punk band in the film. who you know, have, of course, their car breaks down and they have to spend the night in a vampire castle. Boilerplate, like vampire story stuff. I'm assuming there's a lot of nudity and lesbian stuff here, and a lot of just knowing his work, like the bare bones of his work, it's probably going to be what you'd expect from a film called Vampire Killer Barbies.
Yeah, punk band versus vampires. It's exactly what it sounds like. So, I mean, you know, no bones about it. If you're interested in some off-kilter stuff like that, then this is probably a movie you need to check out, especially since Jess Franco is helming the thing. So,
and the Killer Barbies, I should say, they had to retitle the movie, spell Barbies differently to avoid issues with Mattel, but the Killer Barbies are an actual Spanish punk band.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you want to watch that Mattel lawsuit, man, because that'll ruin you. Yeah, definitely. Well, let's move on to, here's one of your favorite distributors, Joel, Severin.
Woo!
From 1986, it's the Devil's Honey. I know nothing about this film. I've never seen it.
No, I am. It is a Fulci film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've seen some of their promotion for this. It seems like kind of an offbeat even for Fulci, like a weird sort of erotic thriller, which is not his usual, element.
Yeah,
you know, his giallo films were not like as explicit and erotic as like a lot of other giallos. It's interesting to see him take on something like this. I mean, it stars Brett Halsey from Return of the Fly. I'm sure the rest of the cast is in other films, like Italian film fans might know, but. You know, I don't know Italian actors like I should, but yeah, Fulci taking on this kind. I'm always interested when he takes on something weird, like out of his normal comfort zone. But you know, I would say his films are like, if Argento did an erotic thriller, I'd be like, well, that fits with like some of his stuff, like Tenebrae. Like, there's a sense of that sensuality among some of his, more down to earth giallo efforts. Fulci, I just don't see that in his stuff. So I'm curious to see like exactly how comfortable he is with this kind of material.
Yeah, and it's probably worth a check out just for that aspect alone, just to see how Fulci handles this type of material. So. Because it's kind of rare for him to delve into this type of stuff, so definitely worth a check out for sure. Okay, we got a couple from Kino. Their main division has a couple, but they have the Classics division that we want to talk about from Kino Classics. A couple of films from the '60s. The first one is Dimension 5, which is kind of like a 60s style spy thriller, kind of like in the vein of James Bond, but probably with maybe how Austin Powers envisions a spy film to work out, you know what I mean?
It feels like a very very over the top, like Moonraker era spy film. I mean, we should say that the main villain is named Big Buddha, and he's played by Harold Sakata, odd job himself.
That's right.
So, it's, you know, I know like there's like atomic weaponry, like a time travel, like they're trying to stop. They're trying to stop LA from being destroyed by a nuke. Like, interesting little, like, over the top, you know,
it's a more tongue in cheek Bond type film. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so it seems like an interesting, fun little curio. I'm actually really interested to see this. I mean, Jeffrey Hunter, he was in the Searchers. He was in a lot of westerns, a lot of war films, a lot of big movies around this time. What I'm most curious about, honestly, is that the lead actress is a Vietnamese actress, which is not like your usual Bond girl kind of thing, especially for the era this was made in.
Oh yeah, for sure. So yeah, that's a curious addition to the cast there, for sure. Okay, cut you off again, Joel. I'm sorry.
Oh no,
man.
Go on.
No. I was going to move on to the next film. If you have anything left on.
No, no. Let's move on to Cyborg.
Yo, Cyborg 2087. This is kind of interesting. It's 1966. It's a time travel. It has a time travel twist to it, but it kind of like precedes the Terminator by 20 years. It's the idea of the future sending someone into the past to prevent a future event. But in this case, I believe, isn't it a protagonist sending something into the past to prevent like a post-apocalyptic future?
Yeah, it's sort of a 12 monkeys-ish thing where he's trying to prevent a scientist from, coming up with this technology that's going to lead to worldwide destruction. And it's a this seems like a really interesting little film, like a pre-Terminator kind of, and not that like time travel, change the future stories or robot stories were not around, at least in sci-fi literature and Weird Tales magazines like that beforehand. But it's interesting to see it committed to film early on, and it's got a cast of like genre favorites and just good actors. I mean, Adam Rourke's in here, who I love, from Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, The Stuntman, a ton of biker films. It just looks like a really cool little film. This is the kind of thing I love when Kino or another distributor finds like a really fascinating, sort of ahead of its time kind of film.
Yeah, for sure. This is definitely, and considering how often the trope we have in sci-fi films of going back into the past and trying to change something, this is the 60s, so this definitely precedes a lot of that, movies that you have, really blown that trope out of the water. It was before that trope became cool. Is what I'm trying to say. Excuse me. So we've got a couple from Kino Lorber, their main division here. A couple of John Saxon films, Joel. We love John Saxon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Usually if he's in something, he adds a little class to everything he's in, usually. So just because he's got that, clean-cut, well-dressed look to him. And maybe not so much in a few of these films, though.
Yeah.
But, from 1977. These are DVD releases, by the way. From 1977, Moonshine County Express. Saxon is—he's a moonshiner. He's helping out the three sisters fight back against a good old Southern boy racketeer.
I cannot believe they could not spare a Blu-ray release for Moonshine County Express.
It needs a Blu-ray release for sure, but. Tried to find it, but I only found the DVD version only. So be on a lookout for that. I don't think there's a Blu-ray for this just yet. So you're looking for the DVD.
Yeah, and this is a New World Pictures film. Instance of the moonshiner genre, which inexplicably came to life in the 70s and hasn't really been seen since. Like we've talked about things that are like interesting little curios, but And certainly Moonshine Films above all are that. And the cast is interesting. I mean, aside from John Saxon, Marsha Brady herself, Maureen McCormick is here.
Yes.
And, you know, Morgan Woodward, the evil cop with the sunglasses from Cool Hand Luke is in here too, which is always cool. I mean, you know, just low budget film with a ton of familiar people like William Conrad, Marshall Matt Dillon himself from Gunsmoke, and the narrator of Rocky and Bullwinkle. He's here, like just a ton of people you might be familiar with. So it's a nice little curio because of that. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm, you know, it's John Saxon in a New World Pictures Moonshiner film. Like, how could you go wrong?
You can't really go wrong. I mean, I've seen White Lightning and Gator, you know, with Burt Reynolds, who really this whole good old boy genre really went into the stratosphere in the mid 70s because of Burt Reynolds. You know, what you can expect in Moonshine County Express is a lot of backwoods car chases and maybe some shootouts and a lot of corruption from the antagonists in the film and whatnot. So I mean, yeah, this is probably going to fall right in line with what you can expect from a movie like this. Moving on to another Kino Lorber DVD release from 1980. It's called Running Scared. We've got John Saxon in this one as well, but he's joined this time by one Judge Reinhold.
If you've ever wanted to see that great screen pairing of John Saxon and Judge Reinhold, well, this is among them.
Basically the plot of this is two military guys, they decide to just split, and then I believe they get eventually to them getting accused of being spies, and then it's just basically a chase film after that. An early 80s chase action film. Low budget, I might add.
Yeah, and a period piece, because it's set in the 60s, like right before the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Oh, yeah.
So there's actually period music, like Del Shannon, it's Runaway shows up on the soundtrack, which is an interesting little bit of texture that they've managed to get period music for this film. I mean, you know, it was 1980s, so the paying for music rights was not the labyrinthian thing it is now, but I mean, Pat Hingle's here for some reason. Pat Hingle, there you go. Like,
yeah, you just need someone to flesh out a character. Just throw Pat Hingle in there.
Yeah, just like, there also seems to be a bit of a Southern vibe to this too. The character, like, I think there's a lot of like Everglades, like locales here. There, I think the characters themselves might be like Southern boys, so it might be. So I'm guessing this is kind of a late like capitalize on Dukes of Hazzard kind of thing.
Yeah, possibly. I believe there's mention of communism. I believe the AWOL soldiers are accused of communism. So you get a lot of, like, probably some McCarthyism in this film as well.
Yeah, I find that interesting, like, that sort of Cold War period piece in the early 80s. That just seems like a weird combination of, like, moments to, like, put together.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely belongs in the era that it came out in, for sure. Yeah. Let us not forget. Let's go back to Shout Factory for a moment, because on DVD we have a Chuck Norris triple threat. It's all three missing in action films and one deliciously packaged set. What more can you ask for?
And nearly one of them is good.
Nearly one of them is good. That's right.
Spoiler alert, it's the one that Joe Zito directed.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you need to know anything about missing in action films, then where have you been the last 30 years? Basically, you know, Vietnam era stories, post Vietnam, whatever you want to call it. You don't need to go any further than just collecting these three movies, because that pretty much sums up, the 80s craze of Vietnam era action films. You know, Platoon, of course, being the best, but then of course all these low budget, B grade action films that wanted to tell stories in Vietnam with like POWs and sometimes even during the Vietnam War itself. Missing in Action was probably considered, the whole series was considered the top of the barrel for these, which is saying a whole lot about the quality of the rest of them in the genre.
Well, I mean, I guess the top of the barrel for the low budget ones of these, I would say the top is probably like Rambo.
Okay, we'll give him that.
We'll give Stallone a win for once.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
But yeah, I mean, you know, Rambo on like the spate of very serious award winning Vietnam movies in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, like Deer Hunter and Platoon and Hamburger Hill and Apocalypse Now, like I all led to the, I mean, people just for some reason couldn't get enough of Vietnam.
Yeah, I know, right? And then, of course, we had, like, the Tour of Duty television series, and that took off for a while. And I believe, you know, it's just then a lot of, like, low-budget, you know, film companies just wanted to create just a good action film. Mostly unsuccessful. One that comes to mind is a movie, I don't know if you've ever seen it or heard of it, but it was called POW, The Escape. And just a lot of stuff in that vein just came out in the mid to late 80s after Platoon popularized it, I guess. And Missing in Action was one to, Missing in Action, the first one, preceded Platoon, of course. But all the sequels, everything just basically became just like your average run-of-the-mill, you know, action film that just took place in Vietnam.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen POW The Escape, but based on this cast, I kind of totally want to.
Yeah.
I mean, David Carradine, Steve James, Mako, I love me some Mako. If you're familiar with, of course, his roles in the Conan films, but, yeah, you know, for me, like, he's a legend because of, you know, his voice work on Samurai Jack and Avatar The Last Airbender. But I mean, I'm a big fan of his Uncle Iroh work on Avatar.
Yeah, so, so there's a recommendation for y'all. POW The Escape. Instead of the Chuck Norris Triple Threat, which is out on DVD from Shout Factory this week.
Yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen the Missing in Action films and you really like, desperate for some Vietnam in your life. Missing in Action does have kind of that interesting backstory where the second one is actually the first one they made, and it was kind of a disaster, and Joe Zito said, let me make a Missing in Action film, put it out first, and then you won't have to worry about this one making money.
No, we don't want to make any money. Let's move on. We still have a couple we haven't mentioned yet. We want to bring attention to the Steelbook version of Bride of Reanimators coming out this coming week.
Yeah, nice Arrow release, I believe.
Yeah,
and you know, I've been meaning to pick up one of their Blu-rays of Bride. It's an excellent movie. A lot of people have probably only seen Reanimator, but Bride, I don't think it's quite as good, but it's very good.
Yeah, I recently introduced Mrs. Jordan to both Reanimator and Bride of Reanimator, and now she can't get enough of them, and she's watched them on repeat several times through streaming, but now she wants to own hard copies of each one. I've turned her into a huge fan of Reanimator and Bride of Reanimator, and it's good to see something like that, because you know, movies like this, 30 years old, a lot of people now may not give them a pass if they had if they didn't see them the first time around. You know, these movies are something that you need to check out at least once, because just the amount of stuff that happens in these movies is just insane. There's just a lot of kinetic energy. There's a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of it's just insane.
Oh, my God.
And so, yeah, they're both just good time, fun films.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the characters are unforgettable. The performances are great. Like, it's just... The special effects, of course, are just absolutely top notch. I mean, great people worked on these. Yeah, Screaming Mad George, who also I should say that Bribery Animator is directed by Brian Yuzna, of course, yeah. The original by Stuart Gordon, and so Screaming Mad George worked on Society with Brian Yuzna. John Carl Buechler worked on Bribery Animator as well, and you know he directed Friday 13th 7, and you know has done effects work on like every other film known to man.
Yeah. Also I want to make note that the head of Dr. Carl Hill almost made my list of sci-fi villains that we did a few shows back.
Carl Hill is a phenomenal villain, and the fact that they found a way to bring him back for this as a head for Batwings
it was awesome and genius.
It's kind of amazing that they took H.P. Lovecraft and turned his work into this. I mean, that was always much more pulp than... Herbert West Reanimator was a much more pulp story than his usual work, and I don't think he was particularly fond of it compared to his cosmic stuff, but, you know, it made for great movies.
Yeah. And then finally, The Princess Bride. I know there's a lot of Princess Bride fans out there. The 30th anniversary, is it Blu-ray?
I believe it is, yes.
Yeah, it's being released this week. And, of course, everyone knows the Princess Bride. If you haven't, then I don't know what's wrong with you. There's no explanation for it.
It's one of those, like, just absolutely perfect movies. I'm sure we've had Blu-rays before. I'm not sure if this is, like... much of an upgrade from previous ones, or if it's just reskin for the anniversary. But if you don't have it on Blu-ray already, it's like it's you know a good opportunity to pick up a copy, because it's one of those films. I think anybody who likes it will like rewatch and rewatch and rewatch.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Well, with all that said, that's quite a slew of new releases. That we piled up for you this week. Hope you took notes. Plenty out there to choose from. You know, pick and choose wisely. Some of the good, some are not so great. But we definitely like to bring you the service of letting you know what's coming out.
It's a real deluge this week.
It is.
And it's probably going to be like that for the next month, so strap in.
Looking forward to it, yeah.
Hide your wallet.
Yeah. But let's move on, because we have some movies to talk about. Now, this is part of what we talked about at the top of the show. We're going to change things up a little bit. We've decided to just discuss two films, basically, as a comparison of each one, maybe the similar themes, similar directors, whatever the case is, screenwriters. Kind of like how we used to do the double bill spill. Where we would each recommend a film that was similar in some style. But now, this is going to be the meat of the show. And we wanted to talk about a couple of films this week. Of course, the first being the hot new release out there right now, and that is the film It, the reworking of the Stephen King's novel. Which, of course, went on to become a very well-remembered and popular miniseries back in 1990. But now it's a big-screen adaptation, and it's the first of what's going to be two parts. And this part tells the story of the kids. They've reworked it so that it takes place in the 80s now, the late 1988, 89, I believe. And you know the story. The small town of Derry, Maine... has been terrorized every 27 years with missing children, missing adults as well, but mainly missing children. And of course, Joel, you know, the movie has a great opening scene depicting brothers Bill and Georgie creating a paper boat, and Georgie taking it out in the rain to sail it down the gutter. And we know what happens from there. I'll tell you what, this scene was set up perfectly, and I want to get into it. But one thing I noted about this, and you'll note the same thing, and everyone probably notes the same thing, is we've got a child in danger here, Joel. And that's kind of, it's, in most cases, it's been kind of taboo, I guess, in films to show harm coming to children. But this one, this scene in particular, was pretty pretty graphic.
Yeah, it really sets the tone for the rest of the film. I mean, of course, you know, children being in danger is part and parcel of it. It's, you know, any kid-oriented horror film has at least an element of that, but usually it's not incredibly graphic death. And that's what, I mean, it sticks straight to how, to Georgie's death in the original novel.
Yeah.
And, I mean, like, yeah, it's a short list of mainstream films that really commit to violent death of a child. I mean, Jaws did it. Mimic did it, I feel like, much less successfully than Jaws or this, because it kind of just felt like an attempt to shock in that, where in here it spurs the entire plot, it spurs the main arc of our lead character, or our co-lead character, I would say, in this one. Bill and Beverly are our two co-heroes, and you know, in Jaws, of course, it spurs Chief Brody into moral reflection and then into action out of it. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily think that like a kid dying in a movie is incredibly taboo for me, but you know, for most people, and you can assume that if you're a mainstream R-rated film, it's going to be, you're going to have a ton of parents in the crowd. Although when we saw it, there were a ton of kids the age of the Losers Club, which was awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I want to talk about more in a bit. But yeah, you can assume, like, there's going to be a lot of parents, and like, this kind of thing is going to affect a lot of them very acutely. So filmmakers are going to be a bit more reticent about doing anything very, very violent with that, or very graphic, or at least even very like visible on screen with that kind of moment.
Yeah. Well, I'll backtrack a little bit and say that, you know, children coming to harm in films isn't quite taboo, but I mean, you know, for example, in Pet Sematary, of course, you know what happens to Gage, but they show it. They don't really depict it physically. You just, you know, put two and two together from everything, and he's like, oh, man, that kid was just creamed by that truck. But, I mean, in It, I mean, what happens to Georgie, for me anyway, it didn't affect me, but, I mean, it was surprisingly graphic. And so, I mean, that's just, like, right out of the gate. I mean, it's like, oh, wow, this is going to be that kind of movie.
Yeah. Now, it does set the tone. And, yeah, I have – it's not taboo for me. I have concerns about how well it particularly worked. Because one of my main – although I am very positive about this film, one of my main concerns is how much of the big scare moments – worked as opposed to, or didn't work, as opposed to how much of the build-up moments worked very, very well. And I thought that the Georgie scene kind of set a precedent for that, because you get a lot of over-the-top CGI. Like, this, I feel like a lot of this version of It, in terms of the scare scenes, is actively like looking back at the miniseries and saying, let's do this just a bit bigger. Yeah. And it kind of starts hammering home the same thing over and over. There's a not that It is necessarily going to be the most subtle thing, but with how well all the tension building sequences worked. Like when it gets to the actual scares, like they get very rote sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and I wanted to hit on that because a few of the scenes, the big scares, you know, each individual kid in the cast has their scare moment, and the ones that didn't quite work for me was the one that Beverly had in her bathroom. That one didn't quite work for me because I've seen that done a million times in other movies. And the other one that didn't quite work for me was the scene with Stan in the painting.
The Bev scene did work for me for the reasons the Stan painting scene. I wouldn't say that didn't work for me, but I would say it points out some issues I had with it. The Bev scene worked for me because what she's enduring is a representation of everything she's feeling. Like she's concerned with her own adolescence, with, you know, the process of going through puberty, with how much negative attention she's getting for her body. I mean, her classmates are slut shaming her even though she has, you know, no sexual experience. Her father, or at least sexual experience with her classmates, like everyone says she does. Her father is openly attracted to her if he hasn't already been, you know, abusing her.
Yeah.
While she's cutting her hair to make herself less attractive to her father, which apparently is something that people in abusive situations like this actually will do. It's aiming for a certain veracity, like that all this, you know, hair comes out of the drain, wraps around the drain of the sink in her bathroom, wraps around her, it's choking her, it's trying to pull her in, and all this blood comes out, and of course, you know, I mean, it may be overdone in terms of, like, we've seen blood as representative, as, yeah, like, a representation of, you know, fears over, like, female bodily development over, you know, menstruation. Like, you know, it's Carrie. Like, this is not new for Stephen King. But yeah. I thought it worked because it reminded me most of the opening scene of Dream Warriors, where, you know, Kristen is in the bathroom and the fixtures on the sink come alive, and like from Freddy, they cut her wrists, and when she wakes up, she's the one holding the razor that cut her wrists. Like, has a representation of like internal turmoil. Like, I thought it worked very well.
Yeah, I mean, what I probably want to clarify is that in terms of scares, I mean, that scene really didn't work for me. I didn't have like a creepy, you know, feeling going into it, but it was very well filmed and quite vivid in the use of the color, so that had it going for it. But in terms of just the anticipation, once she started looking down the drain, you knew something was coming.
Oh, absolutely. I think the use of the hair was interesting and unexpected enough for me that it really worked for me. Now, with the Stan scene where he's menaced by a painting in his rabbi father's office. Now, I should say that the painting is, I'm not sure if it's an actual Modigliani painting or just like in that style, but you know, that is it's a little inexplicable. I know the director, Andy Muschietti, if I'm saying that right, is a big fan of that artist's work. I know certain things in one of his previous films, Mama, was based on Modigliani's style, and I didn't understand why that was in his dad's his very like tight ass, you know, strict father's den, until I found out Modigliani is a Jewish painter, and that's probably a culture, like a cultural you know, tribute thing.
Yeah.
Like, just, you know, in the same way, like, and a lot of, like, old school Italian Catholics will have copies of Dante books around.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the original in the Cary Fukunaga script, original script, had Stan menaced by a naked woman inside his synagogue who was sort of aggressively touching herself and coming on to him.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that would have turned like creepy, distorted, skewed in some way. But like, you know, those are the kinds of like, I mean, I like understand what they're going for here is that like, you know, you're a kid, like your parents probably have like some creepy thing in the house, whether it's an old toy or a portrait or just something that has always unnerved you, which is cool. I just think that like, especially because he's in such a precarious position, like he's studying for his bar mitzvah, he's gonna be a man, like that, like having like in the original script focusing on his fear over that is really interesting to me.
Yeah, that would have been that kind of would have been a more interesting take, I think, than what we got with the painting. You take what you can get, and like we were talking about, some of those things didn't work, but and this was one of them. But it definitely that's an alternative that they could have taken, and unfortunately, it didn't work out. But what you're saying. How you're describing it definitely, it probably would have probably fit in better with the theme of the film.
I think so. I mean, I think the scene as filmed did work. It's another example where the build-up was great. Like, you know, the painting falls, it picks it up, like the figure on the painting is gone. He's immediately freaked out. Behind him, you see part of the, you know, distorted woman on the painting, but you don't see her face. You don't see her face. She's holding a flute that drops. And like that build-up, it's just so well-paced and it works so well. Then you get the big noise, boom, jump scare, like, which is very modern horror. I mean, it's like, you know, Insidious or Paranormal Activity or like
Yeah.
The Conjuring, like that's like the style, and which is fine because I mean this wasn't made for a small market. This was made to be like the big Halloween film of 2017. So I get it. Like they want something the audience is like predisposed to respond to. But, you know, for me, the tension building was so good, and when like all the tension in me got deflated when those big jump scare moments happened.
Yeah, jump scares. I'm surprised there weren't any cats in this film jumping out of closets.
Oh my God. That,
The false alarm jump scare.
yeah, there was actually a distinct lack of false alarm jump scares, which actually may have helped, like because when a jump scare happens in this, like it's the thing that's happening.
Yeah.
It's it. Like, you know, it's Pennywise or one of his forms. I feel like more false alarm jump scares might have like mixed it up a bit.
Oh yeah, for sure. But hey, one scene that did work for me though was the scare that Mike had when he's delivering the when he's coming back. I guess he's delivering, making a delivery, and you know the alley door. Someone's banging on the door. Then all these hands come out and like they're burned. And when the door finally opens, you know you can see. The eyes of Pennywise in the background glowing, and he's beckoning to Mike, and that scene really worked for me. I think for me,
That worked
for
so
me,
well.
for me, that was probably the best of the individual scare scenes for each kid.
Oh yeah, it's structured so well. Like, you know, there's no jump scare. It's frightening on its own. It doesn't need to jump out at you because the image is so. It's grotesque, but you don't see all of it. You see enough to know what's behind that door. And then even when you see Pennywise's eyes and he's kind of beckoning, he almost looks like he's swinging back and forth, like he's hanging,
Yeah.
which, and the whole thing is very racially tinged, obviously Mike being the one black kid, the losers. And it's tied into some backstory of Derry and of Mike's history where, you know, there was you know, they bring up, and this was in the original novel too, that one of the previous one of the previous disasters caused by it was a nightclub fire back in the in the 60s.
Yeah, the Black Spot it was called.
Yeah, it's a black nightclub, and you know, a northern equivalent of the KKK starts the fire, because part of what it does is rally the town against scapegoats to blame all the murders and everything on.
Yep.
Every sequence, you know, every sequence being every time it wakes up. And Mike now lives with his grandfather. His parents die in a fire, which is very much implied to be another racially motivated fire. Although it was his house rather than, you know, any kind of sort of public thing, but he's clearly got a lot of survivor's guilt over that. Mike doesn't get a lot of screen time in this, unfortunately, but you know, what's there works really well. And it's generally speaking, I think every time the film, like the scares are born, like from within the experiences or very, very personal concerns of the kids, it works extremely well, which is one of the things I loved about Tim Curry in the original, is that whenever he talks to the kids, he'll talk to them for an extended period of time, and it will like betray a complete knowledge of everything going on inside them. Like, it's a very poisonous intimacy, and it works really well because, like, you know, fear is a big motivating feeling in childhood because you're so vulnerable and powerless. But the other bit, I always feel like the other big motivation in childhood is shame, like being found out, like not just for things you've done wrong, but for things that are abnormal about you or things that are weak about you, or that you perceive as weak, that you feel like other people might perceive as weak. And one of the reasons Pennywise in the original worked so well, and a similar character like Freddy Krueger worked so well, is that they know all of that about you, and there's no hiding anything anymore.
Right. Definitely. One of the creepier aspects of Pennywise is that he knows exactly what scares you.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about the plot. I did want to mention, you know, Finn Wolfhard as Richie. Now, his character doesn't get one of those scenes. Now, he doesn't encounter it until they're watching the slideshow, and the slideshow comes to life and scares the bejeebas out of them. We don't also, I think Richie is really the only character that doesn't get like some kind of sad backstory to him like the other characters do.
Yeah, it might just be that there's less to really attack Richie with, because he doesn't have that backstory. He just seems to be like a motor mouth, hyperactive kid.
Oh, yeah.
Without any significant pain in him. And it might be just that everything about him is such a front, and it's so locked up that maybe he did have one of those moments and never told anybody about it, or maybe it was waiting to spring it on him during the worst possible time. because he's the one that, like, you know, at one of the turns of the film, like, the group breaks apart because they're after Eddie gets injured when they go into house on Neeble Street to try to kill it. Like, the group breaks apart, and I almost feel like the lack of attacking Richie before this moment was a very strategic decision, both in the screenplay and by it, because he's the one guaranteed to react like in the most open, like angry way at something like this. And of course, his fear in this is clowns, which makes it absolutely doubly perfect. Having him forced to be dragged along with everyone who's had firsthand experience of how awful this is, like very intimate personal experience of how awful this situation is, and him not the only one who hasn't experienced this, is like immediate. Like, if it knows these kids, he knows that Richie's gonna be the one to be like absolutely like annoyed that he has to go through all this. And then when he springs the clown room on him, he is done with this shit permanently.
Yeah, That was great stuff, especially surrounding the character Richie. Or he uses a Modoc. He gets some of the best lines in the film, and the one scene near the end of the film where they're forced to attack Pennywise near the end. I mean, Richie is acting all, Bill is being held hostage by it, and he gives them the choice to leave and leave him with Bill, or they all die. And Richie's the one who stands up and says, you've dragged me through what, shitty water, you've taken me to a crack house, Bill, and now it looks
you
like...
You punched me.
Yeah,
you punched me. Because they didn't have a blow up, because, of course, Richie's the one... We should say for context that Bill is, of course, the leader of this whole initiative because his brother has died, but he's in very deep denial that his brother is gone. He's really convinced that if they just that he's captive somewhere, if they just find him, like they can get him back. Like there's this amazing scene early on where his father's furious at him because Bill is like taken Max's dad had of the town sewer system, like, and built an actual scale model of the pipes using like old building toys.
Yeah,
and to determine like if Eddie got if Georgie got stuck in the sewers, like where he would realistically end up. Like, it's a very interesting but also very realistic way the character's dealing with his grief. Which I find fascinating enough, but yeah. So of course Richie's going to be the one to say, "Deal with it. Your brother's dead. Like, we can't go through this anymore."
Yeah. So I mean, in terms of the characters in the film, I liked Richie a lot, as portrayed by Finn Wolfhard, who of course everyone should know from Stranger Things.
Yeah.
And
a weird circular thing with it inspiring Stranger Things, inspiring it. Like,
yeah, exactly. So in terms of the plot, Joel, do you think the plot strong, solid plot? You got any holes that you want to punch through it or anything?
I think it's as strong as it was going to be from the actual source material, because the source material is very it's a lot of stuff thrown together. So, like, finding a structure in the middle of that, like paring down the plot is very difficult to do. I think they did it really well here with focusing. You know, obviously some characters are going to be a little out of focus and a little more in focus. Like, making it sort of like, this is Bill's search for his brother, and it's centered around that, I think works really well. And the rest, like, all the kids have, like, sort of mini arcs. Bev has probably the biggest aside from Bill, because she's the one who's dealing with all this public shame and all this private like pain and frustration. I think the plot was as strong as you could possibly make it out of the source material, because they just centered it around the characters, personal dilemmas, and just like tightened as much as they could.
Yeah, the plot was never dull. There was always something interesting going on screen, so there was never really a dull moment, so there was really no downtime during the story. And of course, one scene, of course, logically built to the next one, and in terms of knowing that this is the first of a two-part film, there's still some questions that need answered, but they'll probably get answered in the second one. Mainly revolving around Pennywise, of course, and like what it really is, because we saw his underground lair, and we saw the floating children, and there was that scene where he opened his mouth and Beverly stared into it, and she was hypnotized, whatever the case. She went catatonic. So, by the time it ends, we still don't quite know. I mean, if you go in cold and you hadn't read the book and you don't know the story and you're just going to see it because you've heard all the hype about it and you want to check it out. So there's still that unanswered question of what Pennywise or it really is, but, you know, that's probably something that's going to be addressed, you know, by the ending of the second part.
Yeah, I mean, it seems a shame because one of these scenes they wanted to do in this that they just didn't have the budget for was the Smokehouse Vision Quest scene, Smoke Lodge Vision Quest scene, yep. Where they discover the origins of it as kids, which is a shame they lost out on that, but I feel like the search for its origin it could be a great driving force for the sequel, because traditionally with this story, the kid sequences have always been more interesting than the adult ones. So, I mean, that was the case in the original novel, in the original miniseries. Like, I feel like giving them something to search for, like, King sort of got around that by giving them basically amnesia. Like, everyone who left Derry, which is six of them, only Mike stayed behind to sort of be sort of the watch.
Yeah, he was the guardian. The lookout, yeah.
Yeah, he's the only one who really remembers it in full. And I feel like that's really a really unsatisfying, like, plot obstacle, because you've already been through so much with these characters and having them, like, relearn what you already know has a reader or has a viewer is, it just feels like superfluous and not, like, really satisfying at all. But if you, like, make the focus of the second one when they're adults, like, them searching for, like, the nature and meaning of it to try and destroy it permanently, I think that's a great way to go with it without necessarily saying, like, oh, they're learning about it again. Like, just let them know about it and then learn more about it.
Right. So, yeah, good plot, good solid plot, plenty of scares within the plot. We'll delve into that just a little bit more. But let's talk about the cast a little bit. Now, you know, we've gone into it already a little bit, but in your opinion, Joel, which performance did you appreciate best?
It's a tough call because I will say, like, immediately that this is – I don't think this is one of the greatest horror films of all time, but I think, like, if you were making a list of great, like, kid-centric horror films, like, great kid performances in horror films, I mean, this is up there. Like, the kids in this are up there genuinely with, you know, the kids in The Innocents, or, you know, with the little girl in Curse of the Cat People, like, or, you know, Carol Ann and Poltergeist. I mean, this, I think, if it's an all-time classic in any way, it's the kids, because they're just absolutely phenomenal. I would say I love all of them. They're all, like, absolutely amazing. I'd say the real breakout performance for me is Sophia Lillis as Bev.
Right, I agree with that. Yeah, there was she made it feel like this, you know, this... there's just an element, I guess, of, like, realism, and, like, her backstory. We're not talking about, I guess, the scares with Pennywise, but just the backstory of her and her dad. A strong performance there for that situation.
Yeah, her performance is so well modulated. I mean, it never gets, like, despite, you know, the extremely difficult and, you know, potentially melodramatic subject matter that she is being abused by her dad emotionally and probably sexually. If he hasn't yet, it's clear that he's, you know, inclined towards that. All the pain she deals with in public, like the, all the slut shaming she's dealing with, totally unearned. And she handles all of this with what feels like such veracity, such realism, in a way that it's like you feel everything along with her, and it never feels like nothing feels like a wrong note. Nothing feels off. Yeah. Like, it's such a, and it still doesn't compromise her as a character. I mean, usually the that kind of victimization makes a character like just a martyr. There's like, she's bold and she's strong, and you know, she's still very, she's still an incredibly sensitive, thoughtful person. Like, yeah. I, you know, there's of course the, there's a, you know, romantic triangle in this that I think is so well done, and usually those are so awful, like where like Bill, our leader kid, who, and Ben, the new kid, who's also, you know, a, he's the fat kid. I mean, that's how he's known. Like, aside from being the new kid at school, like, and you know, they're both crazy for Bev. Bev obviously, you know, reciprocates Bill's feelings, but she's also really like, obviously as a friend, but just genuinely has strong, like a lot of love for Ben too. Like, she handles it so gracefully, yeah, with him, that it's like, that's a level of maturity like most adults in a situation like that can.
The little subtle new kid on the block jokes between her and Ben were
amazing.
Yeah, some of the funny stuff, especially when she reveals the poster on the back of his door, and he kind of shakes his head at her very gently, and she hides it. She closes the door back over.
Yeah, like, she teases him, but very gently. It's very like friendly teasing.
Yeah,
like, you know, there's a, it's just, and that's another thing about this film, that the characters, like the kids, all interact in such authentic feeling and very like innocent and intimate ways. Like, it's like, you know, the scene with that, like, they're all like at the gorge, like there's a big cliff over, like, you know, and over, you know, a big lake or a big reservoir, and they're all ready to jump in, but they're all like, it's the five boys, this is before Mike's part of the group, and they're all like daring each other. They're like standing at the edge, like, you know, who's gonna jump first. Bev shows up, just like rips off her dress, jumps, like runs off the thing and jumps in, and they're like, well, we can't be shown up by a girl, we have to do this now. like and then there's that moment where, like, you know, like, Bust a Move starts playing, and they're all like hanging out, and Bev's like suntanning with glasses on. I feel like there's a bit of a Kubrick Lolita thing going on there, but it doesn't feel lascivious, which I think is a minor miracle in a movie. Like, because any attraction towards Bev in the film is coming from these characters, so you're less like looking at a male gaze of a teenage girl and more looking at like a bunch of young guys try to figure out how they should be reacting to this teenage girl.
Yeah.
Which is just so much of it. Like, this film works for me because it feels like an accurate representation of childhood.
Yeah.
Like, and of course, you know, we haven't really gotten into the fact that they all cuss like sailors, even the more sensitive or more introverted ones, which is great, because that's how, like, it's very Bad News Bears in that this is how kids talk, their parents aren't around.
That's how kids talk, man. I've lived it.
I've lived it too.
I'm still living it.
I'm still mentally 13 and swearing like a sailor. Yeah, like, you know, they're it's a great scene of like they're in the water, they're like having chicken fights in the water. Like, you get Bill and Bev looking at each other like they really like each other. Ben like is looking at Bev very like very enamored of her, but and recognizes what's going on between Bill and Bev, but like it's all handled very under the surface. There's no big like fight over it. Like, there's no drama over it. It's just your feelings are your own. They're, you know, locked within you, and so sometimes you get a chance to express them and sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what being an adolescent is, and it's just so phenomenally and sensitively done. Yeah, if the film is going to be a classic in any way, it's through all this.
Yeah. So the kids were great as an ensemble. Isn't some of the individuals Wyatt Olaf as Stan, and he didn't get a whole lot of to do. I would say that. And of course, Finn Wolfhard as Richie, of course, was another standout. But let's get to Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise. My opinion on this, basically, he's going to be compared to Tim Curry. No, there's no way around it. And, of course, Tim Curry, you know, set the standard for this role. But the thing with this version of it and Bill Skarsgård is that, yeah, he was, you know, the centerpiece of a lot of the scare scenes, the jump scares, whatever have you. And, of course, the special effects surrounding all of that. But in terms of chewing the scenery and getting the chance to act, I really think Skarsgård was not given a whole lot of material to work with for the most part.
No, he really isn't. I think there's three moments he gets where he gets to, like, really do something interesting. The Georgie scene at the beginning, the end of the House on Meeple Street sequence where Eddie's fallen through the second floor. Yeah. He's broken his arm. The kids are trying to protect him. Pennywise is screaming at him and trying to scare the life out of him, about to kill him, and the kids like rush in to help. And you know, he has this great moment where like Bill's trying to convince him that Eddie,
he's not real.
Yeah, he's not. That this is basically just an illusion meant to terrify us and take our power that way. And he yells at Bill, "Is this not real for you, Billy? Is this not real enough?" He has the tone of a jilted lover when he says this, which is interesting. I read a bit of an interview with Skarsgård where he was saying he was trying to play it like a very strange lost child, That immediately brought to mind that scene and the third scene. He gets a chance to really shine, which is the one where he's got Bill hostage.
Yes,
and he's telling the kids he's giving them that offer and saying you can go and leave and thrive and go back to the weeds when old age takes you. There's something very creepy about just those lines and the way he delivers them to me. That he seems almost outside the realm of human experience. He's just saying you're nothing to me, and humanity is nothing to me. And here's your one chance to live your sad, pointless little life. That's a very nice cosmic villain moment, and I wish we had gotten more of that. Like I said, what really always works for me in a story like this or in the Nightmare on Elm Street movies is when Pennywise or Freddy Krueger really betrays a distinct knowledge of what these kids are afraid and ashamed of, and we don't get enough of that because we get him coming in weird forms like the Modigliani painting, like the weird distorted woman from that, or the weird leper that it's a leper in the book, but here it's almost more like a weird distended ghost leper that attacks Eddie, the hypochondriac kid. The forms are interesting visually, but I just wanted more of that. I know you. I know what you're. Everything about you. None of it matters to me. Be afraid and be ashamed. That's interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, so I hope that in the second installment that maybe they'll stretch Skarsgård out a little bit more. I assume he's returning for the second one, am I right?
Yeah, he
okay.
is.
Okay, great, okay. So, it was a great start, but it kind of left you wanting a little bit more. And really not Skarsgård's fault because, more of the screenplay itself, not really giving him an opportunity to chew it up more. But still, in terms of the costuming and the makeup and everything, in my opinion, he looked slightly more off-kilter than Tim Curry did. So, kudos there because they definitely made Pennywise look like a scary clown.
Yeah, and that's also kind of a difference in how they also kind of a difference in how they approach the character. Like in the original, like Tim being more of a normal looking clown is like how he draws the kids in, how he draws their attention first and then springs the trap on them. And he does that in the initial scene, in the Georgie scene in this, where he's he's creepy, but he's trying to be like, he's trying to be sort of friendly with Georgie before he like, springs on him. Here he just like outright scares them, and then after the scare, he'll like pop out like, "Hey, I'm Pennywise. I'm here." Like not saying anything, just reminding you that there's something behind all this.
Yeah. Let's talk about a little bit of the film work itself. The director, Andy Muschietti. I really think, now I'm not familiar with what he's done previously. And let's check that out a little bit here because, yeah, Mama. You
I mean,
mentioned Mama earlier. I think that's pretty much all he's done.
yeah, I mean, and that was a big hit, of course. I mean, he did a short film of that, a few years before he did the feature length one. I'm sure the short film is what got the attention enough to do the feature length, and it was a big hit. And then he got this job off that. But yeah, I mean, he's an extremely young director and handled a not a huge budget, but he's also not terribly young. He's like in his 40s, but he like for that level of experience to take on a big sort of tentpole horror film is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I think he did a great job with pacing. You know, the pacing of the film was great. It has what the running time's about 2 hours and 15 minutes, but it never feels like a long movie.
No, it never does. I was impressed. I knew going in it was an over 2 hour running time, and it just never reaches the point where there's nothing draggy about it.
Exactly, and that's a credit to Machete, you know, just keeping it moving, keeping the story flowing. So there was a lot of good flow in this movie, and a lot of great camera work as well. And we have I believe a Korean cinematographer on this. It's Chung Hoon Chung.
Yeah,
who's worked a lot in like Asian horror films, of course. So that he brought that experience over from some of these really truly creepy Asian horror films over here to North America.
Yeah, he's a.
Yeah,
Oh,
I
sorry.
just wanted to shout, the opening scenes with the rain. There's like an overhead shot of the rain falling, which is pretty cool. So I mean, there was a couple of times of overhead camera shots, like the rotating overhead camera shot, you know, taking everything's in. This is probably a cinematographer whose work I should probably check out more.
Oh yeah, he's a frequent collaborator with Park Chan-wook. I mean, he's done the cinematography for like everything he's done since Old Boy, I believe. Which is interesting because he's done a lot of he's which means he's done a lot of action films, a lot of revenge stuff, and that doesn't really shine through here because, like, I think there's a lot of like quick cuts in the attack, in the like big attack scenes, but like there's, I think it's remarkable for like a lot of long lingering shots. I mean, not to the extent like Orson Welles might do or something, like the Third Man has, but I mean, just like a lot of shots that like are really good at capturing the whole scene, capturing the town around you. A lot of shots that go from, larger expansive shots of like this set of this idyllic summer and this wonderful landscape to like close up shots of the characters and like the subtle expressions of their feelings. And then, you know, when it's summer, the look of the film is so beautifully lit. It's so, like, lush. And, you know, when the horror stuff starts happening, it's so arid and so gloomy, oppressively gloomy. It's like just every feeling comes through. It comes through in these shots. It's just wonderful work.
Yeah, and of course the location shooting as well. They definitely, I believe they filmed this on location. I believe they went to, I think it was filmed in Maine, most of it. And of course, you know, it has that small town look and feel to it. You know, the older looking buildings in the downtown, and you know, the surrounding forest and lakes and rivers and whatnot. So I'm always a big fan of, you know, on location shooting rather than using things like green screens and whatnot. So this definitely is another thing to the film's credit, the genuineness of the town of Derry.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's just a great evocation of, like, a small town. It's a great period evocation of the 80s. Like, I mean, it's taking all those things, like, Stranger Things has done and honestly improving on it.
Yeah. So, with that said, Joel, do you have any other final thoughts on it here before we get to our closing on it?
You know, there's just so much in this film, and, like, it's one of those things where, like I said, not all of the horror works, not all of the, like, the jump scares kind of drag it down, sort of. There's a sense of repetition in, like, the individual scares that I think sort of cuts, undermines the tension. But I think fundamentally the cast and their interactions are so accurate and so moving and just so engaging that it's a film, like, even if not all of it works, I'm probably going to end up buying it as soon as it comes out. It's just one of those films where I just want to experience life alongside these kids. Quite frankly, I don't want a sequel where they're adults. I want a bunch of sequels where these kids are going around, like, Scooby-Doo style, solving mysteries.
The Scooby-Doo gang, yeah.
No, I want to see him take on, like, Christine and, like, other, like, and, like, other Stephen King villains. Just do that. Just give me, like, do, like, Lin Shaye in the Insidious movies. Just give me these characters in new situations. I don't care about Pennywise anymore.
They unmask Christine to be Old Man Carruthers.
He was just pretending to be a car the entire time. No, I would love that.
Like, yeah. And I think, my thoughts on it. Good film. Maybe even very good, not great. It's probably going to be turned into a classic because that's what happens with these things. Joel, box office at this point, $438.2 million.
Just insane. I mean, largest horror movie box office by, like, a huge margin. I think the previous one was Interview with a Vampire. That's how long
against,
it's been.
Against a budget of $35 million. So, I mean, this made a lot of people very rich.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, I'm sure we're going to get a bigger budget, more special effects, probably a couple of big names in the next one. Like, I would not be surprised, like, if Jessica Chastain comes back, which she was in Mama, comes back to be older Bev. Like, that's been one of the big rumors. You know, so we're going to see a bigger film next time. I'm not sure it's going to be as good a film. There's a lot more issues with the second half of the original source material, with the second half of the novel, than there are with the half set in the childhood era of the story.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a much more difficulty in adapting that, I think, just from the perspective of making an engaging, interesting film. So it's going to be a difficult thing for them to pull off. They're going to have a good opportunity to, but it's going to be difficult. You know, I'm going to go into the second one not expecting much, quite frankly. I just kind of like these characters as kids so much. I just want them to stay kids.
Yeah, and that may very well be the case. They may not be able to translate the adult half of the story into a good film. But we'll hold our reservations in check until then. I mean, hopefully the box office for this first one doesn't mean that we're going to get a Pennywise franchise, because, oh my gosh, I do not want to see that. And I think basically we've wrapped up our thoughts on it at this point, and it's time to hit a break, Joel. And what better time to do it? So we'll put the microphones down for a few moments. Hit the bathroom, whatever the case we need to do. Refresh our water, you know.
And when we come back, we are actually not talking about the 1990 yet. You will be. You may be pleasantly or unpleasantly surprised at the film we're going to be discussing next.
We are going to talk about a doozy. So you stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Well, come back. We just got through the first half of the show talking about Stephen King's It, the big new horror release that's doing blockbuster money at the box office. We just analyzed it. We both liked it. And, well, we're going to dedicate the second half to a film that we'll probably have varying opinions on. Hey, Joel. We're going to talk about Ernest Scared Stupid.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the greatest film of all time.
Wait, I thought we were talking about Ernest Scared Stupid.
Of an Ernest Goes to Camp man?
Yeah, see, the opinions are already starting to vary, and we haven't even gotten into it yet. Ernest Goes to Camp. More like Dr. Otto and the Riddle of the Gloom Beam. So, Ernest Scared Stupid, 1991. Of course, it stars Jim Varney as Ernest, and everyone knows the character of Ernest. And he had a Saturday morning television show. Hey, Vern, it's me, Ernest. Who's Vern, Joel? The guy behind
Vern's
the camera.
Vern's just his friend that he's always bothering. Now, a little bit of background on Ernest. He was actually an advertising character. Created for like a local Nashville advertisements, and he would basically just always be bothered. He would be talking to the camera, and the camera would assume the role of his friend Vern, that he'd always have a pointless conversation with, a total like a monologue, and just ramble about something, which inevitably went to like the product he was talking about, and then closed with, "Know what I mean?" Like, you know, the closest comparison I have to this is the Dead Milkmen, the 80s punk band, did a similar sort of monologue structure in the song Stewart, which I suggest if anybody wants to hear like an all-time great weirdo song, go find it on YouTube.
Yeah, I appreciate some Dead Milkmen. I liked Punk Rock Girl. That's probably about the only song I know. Anyway.
They're both on the same album. It's totally worth picking up. Yeah. But back to Ernest.
Yeah, the Ernest Scared Stupid. I think it's the fifth Ernest film. The fifth film to feature Ernest P. Worrell.
Yeah, I think in like the main, what we consider the main like suite of Ernest films, our main concerto of Ernest. It's the fourth one, or at least the fourth one and last one to go to theater. I know, like, there was a bit of backlash to this one because it really, it's a horror comedy, and it actually really pushed the envelope in terms of what they did in this, both scare-wise and gore-wise, and we'll get a bit more into that, but it really did get some parental blowback for being very frightening and very disgusting.
Let's run them down real quick. I think the first one was Dr. Otto and the Riddle of the Gloom Beam. Then there was Ernest Goes to Camp. Ernest Saves Christmas. And then Ernest Goes to Jail. And that's probably where they should have left him.
Whoa. Listen, the man, he was slam dunk Ernest, then he went to Africa, then he went to the army. Ernest did a lot of things for this great nation.
He went to Africa. Oh my goodness, they don't know what to do with him over there. It was the, like you said, it was the final Ernest film to be released theatrically. It was under the Disney label, Touchstone Pictures.
And I'm sure that was part of the friction, too, that, I'm not sure how much of the content Disney as a whole knew going in, but I mean, this was right in the middle of the Disney renaissance. I mean, it came out the same year as Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure Disney did not want to deal with the potential reputation tarnishment from not only an Ernest film, because, they were not well regarded by critics, obviously.
Oh, yeah. And so Disney did the burial job to Ernest.
I mean, there was still money to be made, so they went direct to video, but it was I think it was at least a few years before the next like full-length Ernest film. I mean, although they were still regularly releasing Ernest like compilations of skits and things like that.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, every Ernest film after this went shifted to straight to video, the good old VHS era. Yes, sir. But anyway, one of the things I want to know, of course, right off the bat, the opening credits, you get like a montage of clips from various horror and sci-fi films. Like, what did I see? I saw Nosferatu, the silent film. Nosferatu was in there.
Yeah, White Zombie was in there. One of my favorites, the brain from Planet Eros.
Yeah,
giant brain. Gila monster, killer shrews, like...
Yeah, there was a Little Shop of Horrors was.
Little Shop was in. Yeah, the original Little Shop was in there. I think there's a full list on IMDb. Yeah, Fam from Space was in there. Screaming Skull. I mean, it's a really great. It's a great opening. I mean, regardless of whether or not you like the film, I think most people will think this opening is extremely fun because it's got like spooky fun. If I were to describe the tone of this film, it's spooky fun. Like, it's what, like, you know, it's like the kind of thing that Monster Squad did or Hocus Pocus did. I'm not a particular Hocus Pocus fan, like every other person my age for some reason. Yeah. But, you know, it's got spooky Halloween music. Ernest is, like, walking around in front of the camera making, like, crazy faces. Clips are playing, like... from all these old monster, yeah, I'm sure they're like all public domain monster movies. It's just like a fun, great tone setting little opening, and it's like, you know, it's rare that you have, especially now, that you have an opening like that that's just not connected with the actions of the film.
Yeah, the opening was one of the only things I appreciated from this movie, but I want to touch on the plot a little bit, because then we get into the story that's being told. And we've got, like, in late 19th century, Briarville, Missouri. That's the name of the town that they live in. So we're in middle America here in the late 19th century, and we've got a demonic troll who's turning kids into wooden dolls?
Yeah.
And so the townsfolk capture him, and one of the village elders who happens to be an early descendant of Ernest P. Worrell, what's his name, Phineas?
Phineas.
Yeah, Phineas. Yeah. They capture the troll, and they seal him under a giant oak tree. They plant a tree over him. And Phineas, of course, states that... the troll can only be released on the night before Halloween by the hands of a Worrell. And, of course, we know that 200 years later, we get Ernest, the descendant of Phineas. Is it... Okay, so if we're going... Is it ascendant or descendant?
Descendant. Phineas would be ascendant, I believe, or just like a predecessor.
That's like nitpicking and stuff, but I just want to make sure I get my vocabulary straightened out there. So anyway, so then of course we all know that Ernest, who's not the brightest guy on earth, even though he claims to know a lot, he doesn't really know much of anything.
Well, I take issue with this, first of all. Because I should mention that one part of the process of sealing away the evil troll is that the side effect is that Phineas Worrell's descendants are going to get dumber with each successive generation,
which
of course leads us to Ernest. But like, yeah, there's an odd moment where and a great little weird riff where he's giving an extremely weird recounting of a war with the Mongols to the main kid in the movie, Kenny, who he's kind of like an older brother figure to Kenny. I wouldn't say a father because Ernest isn't that responsible, but he's actually kind of, through his own extremely skewed lens, is actually kind of accurately reproducing strategy from the Art of War. Ernest isn't dumb. He's just insane, which is kind of he just seems dumb because he operates on a different plane of logic than the rest of us.
Really, that's your story, and you're sticking to it, right?
I am a devotee of Ernest P. Worrell.
Well, see, I've got all I see is a garbage truck driver who likes to hang out with little kids.
Well, he is a man child. I mean, it's like Bubba from Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. It seems creepy unless you actually know the character.
Yeah, and he's got, of course, a little dog companion. What was the dog's name in this movie?
Rimshot.
Rimshot, yeah. His dog Rimshot, who surprisingly can drive the garbage truck better than Ernest.
Oh, it's amazing. Like, there's literally for those of our listeners who haven't seen this, those blasphemers, there's literally a scene where he's fighting with the troll on the back of the garbage truck while the dog drives the truck.
Yeah.
It is. And it's actually, here's the amazing thing, is that scene is actually a well-constructed action sequence. It's just completely stupid and wonderful. I know I'm sounding like ironic about this, but I really do find this an incredibly entertaining, like, turn your brain off, just enjoy a fun, goofy, weird, a bit of weirdness. And honestly, there are some things about this film that really, even now, kind of unnerved me, and as a kid, frightened the shit out of me.
Well, this story goes, looking at the plot a little bit, looks like Ernest decides to help his little friends build a treehouse. They enter a part of the woods that's covered with fog, for one thing. And then, of course, Ernest nailing some wood into the tree awakens the troll. And so, therefore, the troll is loose. We need to mention that there's always a crazy old lady. And we get old lady Hackmore, played by Eartha Kitt. And, of course, she knows the story behind everything. And she's pretty pissed when she finds out what's going on with the treehouse. And, yeah, I mean, just Eartha Kitt, you know, some people may remember her as, I guess, Catwoman 2 from the old Adam West Batman series. It's probably what she's best known for. So this is kind of a bit of a stunt casting going on here.
Yeah, I mean, Eartha is just, like, absolutely crazy and awesome in this. Like, you know, she's playing off a lot of, like, what you consider, like, horror movie stereotypes of crazy old ladies and crazy old voodoo practitioners, although she doesn't seem to actually practice voodoo, more like a traditional, witch oriented paganism, and even that's kind of unclear. That might just be to avoid offense, but she is clearly, like, well versed in magic and myth. And we find out by the end that she's actually much older than she seems, because some of her siblings, it seems like, were locked away as wooden dolls by the trolls during the initial troll attack.
Yeah, and so we've got the troll running loose on the town and kidnapping people and turning them into wooden dolls and, you know, sucking up their life force or whatever it is he's doing. And we've got, there's a lot of snot in this movie, too, isn't there?
Oh, my God. It is absolutely gross. I mean, do not watch this while, like, eating anything except maybe popcorn. Like, anything that's going to remind you of the texture of snot, do not, like, go near. We should mention, we haven't yet, that the monster and makeup effects are done by the Kyoto brothers, best known for Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Oh, yeah.
And they... the trolls look awesome. They're, like, part cartoony, part, like, incredibly grotesque.
Yeah, they are pretty ugly.
And, yeah, they're ugly. They're intimidating creations, and they're always, like, leaking something, like mucus and snot and, like, just gross, goopy shit is everywhere in this. I mean, when they start dying because more troll, like more trolls get raised by the main one. You know, they when they die, they get melted into the puddles of goop and blood. It is a surprisingly gory film, but it's gory because all the gore is, you know, ugly trolls that get killed.
Yeah.
Now, as a kid, I mean, quite frankly, like, not only were the trolls frightening and intimidating to me, but the idea that they would capture you and put you in, like, trap you inside a wooden doll indefinitely, that was absolutely unnerving to me. Like, it freaked me right out.
And then, of course, somehow they stumble into the idea that milk is the what kills these trolls.
Yeah, I believe it was something like a very, you know, beaten up, like, piece of information from Phineas Worrell or someone from that era. And, of course, the punchline of that is that Ernest, seeing this with one letter missing, assumes it's authentic Bulgarian Miak that will do the trick, which is not something that exists in real life, obviously. But he attempts to attack the troll with it, and obviously it does not go according to plan.
Miak. Let's get into Ernest a little bit. Now, I mean, if you're going into this cold without any prior knowledge or idea of what an Ernest movie is all about, then this is going to be pretty confusing because he actually plays multiple characters in this film, like Bunny Worrell, Auntie Nelda. I mean, and they just turn up in like quick, short little monologues directed, you know, breaking down the fourth wall.
Yeah, there's very much, like, Ernest does a lot of, like, skits riffing on things. There's a lot of, like, cutaway jokes. I mean, like, years before something like Family Guy, or even years before Simpsons played around with early versions of, like, cutaway jokes, like, you know, Ernest will, like, will monologue, but, like, jump into a bunch of different personalities at the time, like, you know, some of whom are, like, you know, goofier, like, ultra-mundane old ladies, like, you know, some of whom are Genghis Khan, or clearly Richard Burton playing Julius Caesar. He'll just jump between all these personalities, and usually in, like, a monologue riffing on something weird, but sometimes it's actually, like, in the middle of, like, an action scene where he'll do this.
Yeah.
It's like the where he's in the treehouse fighting off a siege of the trolls. He does this. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of like these secondary characters that he's playing just providing commentary on the action on hand.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much at least leaning on, if not, like, totally breaking the fourth wall. And, yeah, like, there's a lot of, like, riffing, like, a lot of jokes. Like, he'll say something and talk about, like, how he doesn't know when to quit, just ask his fourth grade teacher. They'll cut to him like child Ernest, or writing out something on a chalkboard like 100 times while his old teacher's complaining about him.
Yeah.
Like, it's that kind of oddly anarchic goofiness that I think, like, attracted a lot of kids to these movies back in the 80s and 90s. Like, you know, an era of, like, very dumb. It's like, these movies are dumb, but they're dumb in an extremely infectious, like, energetic and surprising way. It's not, like, dumb in the way, like, a lot of 80s cartoons were, where it's just, like, the same goddamn thing over again.
Yeah, you know, he did a lot of that in his Saturday morning television show. I mean, that's basically what it was about. I mean, like, a skit show, kind of like in the vein of, like, Pee-wee's Playhouse, you know, back in the day. And so that element was brought to his films as well. And, you know, some of the jokes are hit, or a lot of them are missed. Some of them are hit. But, you know, for a guy like me, you know, I think I like to think of myself as having a great sense of humor. But, I mean, unfortunately, Joel, a lot of this stuff fell flat with me.
Yeah, I mean, like, they're not the most quality jokes. I think when Barney's sort of like improvising or just riffing is probably why it's the funniest. But like, you know, I think the frenetic pace and just the overall like enjoyable goofiness of this is why I keep coming back to it, because it's just stupid fun.
Yeah. Well,
and like, it's also weird. Like, I think the reason I like this the best out of all the Ernest movies is that like when you put that like in conjunction with really gruesome and like oddly like frightening horror concepts, like there's a very weird tone that emerges from that. That's like, it's like unnerving, and yet at the same time, it's just kind of baffling. I mean, it's been a while since I've gone back to the other Ernest movies, but I feel like they're probably not as successful as this one because it's just such a unique tone.
This one's trying to, you know, recall an era, like, you know, like the opening credits. It's trying to recall the 50s, 60s horror sci-fi era in tone. And I guess it sort of pulls it off and from that respect, so I'll give it props for that.
Yeah, like, I would say, like, almost, like, the tonal equivalent is, like, old Saturday morning TV where you're watching cartoons and at noon it turns to an old monster movie. That's basically the inspiration here.
Yeah.
Like, that mixture of, like, here's some fun stupid cartoons, too. Here's a goofy, creepy monster movie.
Yeah.
Like...
Well, you know what you're in for. I mean, there's a scene in the film where the troll turns Ernest's dog Rimshot into a wooden doll. Poor dog. Dog was one of the unsung heroes of the film, but of course, after the dog gets turned into a wooden doll, here comes Ernest with frozen yogurt all over his hands, scaring the troll off. I mean, come on, the troll's scared of frozen. I mean, I know milk's his weakness and everything, but you know, it's a actually, you know what? When I backtrack a little bit, if Ernest was coming at me with frozen yogurt all over his hands, I'd be like, "Hey, dude, don't touch me, man." I mean, back off.
Yeah, but you're not like deathly allergic to milk in the way that this troll.
These
is.
Trolls are lactose intolerant, you know.
They melt.
They melt. They explode. Whatever the case is, you know, extreme lactose intolerance is what's going on in this film. I think this is an anti-milk message myself.
I mean, I don't think we have to worry. We're not, well, I don't know about you. I'm not personally not a tree troll.
Are we sure about that?
I can take a DNA test. Like, I'm actually not sure
we'll
about
take,
that.
We'll
I just
take,
assume.
One of those DIY DNA kits sent to you in the mail.
Like, I've rarely turned any children into a wooden doll.
let's talk about let's give Jim Varney some discussion here real quick, because you know he's best known for Ernest, but he actually had multiple various other performances and stuff, like most notably like he was Jed Clampett in the Beverly Hillbillies movie, so. Yeah, just he did. Wasn't he the voice of the Slinky Dog in Toy Story?
Yep, in the first two Toy Stories,
yeah.
Slinky Dog.
Yeah, so I mean, he's a versatile voice actor. I mean, he did some Duckman back in the day. Mm-hmm. So I mean, he's probably because of his. Various characters that he played, you know, he's very good at, you know, changing his voice. So he would have made a good voice actor if he'd done more of that. Unfortunately, he left.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he did.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, he did a fairly memorable appearance on the Simpsons. You know, early on, he, of course, did a lot of commercial work, which is how the Ernest role came about. I mean, that was obviously like his... obviously, how his star was made.
Yeah, and of course, he passed away at an early age. He was only 50 when he passed away, but So unfortunately, he's no longer with us. So we can't get the pleasure of seeing Ernest in further adventures, unfortunately, Joel.
And the world is worse for it.
What about the director of Ernest Scared Stupid, John Cherry?
I mean, who has pretty much just done Ernest stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty much all he's done is Ernest Ernest movies, yeah. And
like, I think afterwards he's done some other things for the most part, short videos like for kids stuff, just weird random stuff for TV. But yeah, I mean the Ernest stuff, and I mean he was involved with the building of the Ernest character from the beginning.
Yeah, and I guess basically he knows how to film the character best, and why not just stick with a formula that has worked for you your whole career, right?
Yeah, I mean it's a style that, like, I mean it's kind of a rare thing in the modern era where it's a style that's just built around one actor and one comedian and how they like to approach comedy, which is not really something we get anymore. Like that's almost like a throwback to golden age of Hollywood up through maybe the 50s. But at that point, that was more like most of those kinds of actors were more common to see on television. People like Lucy or Sid Caesar or whoever, Jackie Gleason. Like it's that kind of thing, but it's a style of comedy that we don't get in movies anymore.
Yeah, you could say stuff like kind of like in the vein of like Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, stuff like screwball comedy.
Yeah, it's very goofy slapstick stuff, and like I think the closest like very modern comparison I have to it is like how the later Hangover films became very centered around Zach Galifianakis.
Right. Yeah.
finding a goofy character and just like building around not only that character but like centering the way the film is shot and edited to their style, the actor's style of comedy.
Yeah, so, and a lot of that, if you run into, a comedic character in a film who kind of, steals the film, steals the show, and then that character spins off into something on its own, sometimes that's hit or miss quite a bit. Because then, you're taking a supporting character and you're turning it into a main character, and now you have to flesh it out, and sometimes it just doesn't work. But Ernest is something that started in a commercial and just built from there into a slightly successful franchise. I'll say that Ernest Scared Stupid box office, $14.1 million. That's more than I thought it would have made, so I'll give it some credit.
Yeah, reason. Hey, he had a talking doll. That's a successful franchise.
Well, Ernest Scared Stupid. Joel, I am not going to recommend it. I was not a fan. The plot was just, it had its moments, but overall I just didn't get it. And a lot of the humor fell flat for me. And I mean, it's meant to be a horror comedy, and the comedy wasn't really funny in most cases, and the horror, of course, was just trolls and voodoo curses and stuff like that. So I'm going to take a pass on Ernest Scared Stupid.
And I'm going to recommend the hell out of it. Yeah, and again, this might be a difference in how we came to these, because, I, of course, watched them as a kid. You didn't. So it might, I mean, obviously that's going to color my perception, but...
Absolutely.
For a for a kids oriented horror comedy with a really uniquely weird tone, I would recommend people at least watch a few scenes on YouTube to get an idea of how the weird pace of this film, how the shots are cut together, and that really, especially during Ernest character hopping during his monologues, that very frenetic style, it's just an interesting, and the weird slapstick comedy plus gruesome horror, thing it's doing. It's a very singular, weird movie. So I think it's worth, like, for a weird experience, like, try this thing. See if you like it. If you don't, like, you probably won't forget it.
Yeah. Okay. So, with Ernest Scared Stupid in the books, I guess our consensus this week is check out It. And as a comparison note, Ernest Scared Stupid, proceed with caution.
Proceed with no caution. Just jump right in.
All right. Well, it's that time of the show, Joel. We're going to test your knowledge. It's time for... I need some theme music for it. It's time for Stump Joel. Let's get that 60s game show music going. I don't know. The old Hollywood Squares theme or something. This week's topic is non-franchise slasher flicks. Non-franchise. So no Jasons, no Michael Myers, no Freddy Kruegers. None of that. We're talking about standalone slasher films here. So I'm sure you're quite adept at this topic.
This is one of my favorite types of horror, but let's see how I do.
All righty. We've got 5 questions. Each one pertains to a different film. And we'll kick it off with The Burning.
Ooh.
The Burning. Here's your question. The Burning is loosely based on what urban legend?
Oh, the Cropsey Myth.
Oh, man, that was an easy one. You jumped right in there.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen the Cropsey documentary?
I have not.
About the...
No,
It's really good. And, you know, it's not one I grew up with. It's more of a... yeah, I'm from central upstate New York. That's, I guess, more of a Long Island, Staten Island, and Jersey kind of myth. But, yeah, it's kind of a fascinating piece of, like, cultural history and affected a lot of these horror... A lot of this era of horror movies.
Yeah, okay. That's cool. I'll have to check that out. I knew that it was based on an upstate New York urban legend, but I'm sure there's so much more to it. But, yeah, that's interesting to note, so I'll see if I can look up more information on that. All right, next question, and that one was easy. Jeez, I should have known you'd get that. All right, next question. Black Christmas. From 1974, the original Black Christmas here. In Black Christmas, the killer mentions the name of two people. He mentions himself as Billy. And what is the name of the other person?
Oh, damn it. I was all excited because I was going to say, oh, it's Billy. But, oh, God. Oh, God, it's like a lady's name. It's like an old lady kind of name.
Yes, it is. There's no one named, you wouldn't, no one names their kid this anymore.
Oh, my God, it's, Agnes.
Agnes is correct, yes, sir. You almost said Agatha.
I almost did. I was still in, like, Halloween witchy mode.
Yeah. So, yeah, basically, the quote from the film is, Agnes, it's me, Billy.
Billy, you like, yeah.
What a creepy dude. They never did catch that guy, man. Next film. Question 3. The Mutilator.
Oh.
Now, this isn't really about the content of the film, more about what's the circumstances around the film. So, the Mutilator had to be cut in order to get an R rating. An Arrow Video announced a Blu-ray release in 2015, but had to delay the release because a fully uncut 35mm print was found. Where? Of all places. An uncut 35mm print of the Mutilator was found in this. And this would be, I think, in my opinion, it would be an odd place to find a fully uncut version of the Mutilator.
Is there a normal place to find a fully uncut version of the Mutilator? Oh, God, I feel... when you say found in this, I'm assuming you mean, like, a specific location, well, a specific, like, object, yeah, not like how they found, like, those, like, Event Horizon scenes in, like, yeah.
this is Eastern European
country.
Yeah, and it was actually being stored here.
Oh, God. This is something I don't know, but let me try and just take a shot in the dark. I'm just going to say it's, like... Let's see, it's usable, so that kind of cuts down on where they could have stored it. I don't know. It's the mutilator. Just a car trunk, maybe.
Yeah, just because it was the mutilator, and it struck me as odd that they found an uncut print of the mutilator here. The U.S. Library of Congress.
Wait, what?
Absolutely.
All right. Oh my God! I was thinking it would be like somewhere like just part of a random collection, or just like in a random like garage, not like Library of Congress.
The U.S. Library of Congress had an uncut print of the mutilator.
Oh, so when the Library of Congress really loves fish hooks.
Yeah. Oh man, yeah, that surprised me because like, what the hell is that movie doing in that place?
Oh my God!
All right. Well, that one got you, but this one may not. Okay, question 4. This is Slaughterhouse. Slaughterhouse has been syndicated for television under a different title. What is that title?
Ooh.
And if you know your Slaughterhouse, it kind of makes sense.
No, I know. I'm trying to think of, like, Slaughterhouse references that could be, like, used in, like, a title. Oh God, was it's something ridiculous if I
it
remember.
Is.
Oh God, was it Bacon Bits?
Bacon Bits is the answer.
Yes.
Yes. Oh man.
Oh my God.
That's a horrible title for a movie. I don't care if it's a
screwball. That is the worst
title. I don't care
title.
If it's a screwball comedy. Bacon Bits is a bad title.
That would be a bad title for Porky's.
All right. So, Bacon Bits, your answer. All right. Last question. Alone in the Dark. Jack Shoulders, Alone in the Dark.
Love that movie.
The original idea for Alone in the Dark was to have the mental patients in the story escape to New York City during a blackout and to have who stop them or oppose them.
It was the Mafia.
The Mafia. You got this one. Holy shit, dude. You jumped on that one. Yeah, that was the original idea, was to have the Mafia take on the nutcases.
I mean, that's a really great hook, but I feel like that would never be as good as the one we got. Like that sort of trapped in the house structure always works. It's not. You've got to have your heroes be vulnerable. I feel like, you know, Psychos against the Mafia is just kind of. It's a fun idea that wouldn't be as good a film.
And I love Alone in the Dark because just you got Jack Palance, Donald Pleasance, and Martin Landau all in the same room.
With Dwight Schultz.
Oh yeah, with Dwight Schultz.
With Howlin' Mad Murdock himself.
Quite inspired casting for Alone in the Dark. One of the reasons why we love it.
Oh my God. No, it's a wonderful film. Like a great early Jack Shoulder. Like the cast is phenomenal. Like it got a great like atmosphere, a lot of great tension building, and the characters are just interesting and weird.
Yeah, I love Jack Palance. Probably my favorite Jack Palance movie.
Oh, he's so good in that. Yeah, apparently, but... like, he actually had Jack Shoulder cut a scene where he was going to kill a driver because he said that he didn't need to be shown killing someone to show that he was dangerous.
Oh, yeah, I caught that. I read that recently, and I was like, oh, man, Palance is awesome.
He's so hardcore. Oh, my God.
Well, we're only able to stump you on one, Joel, so I guess we'll give you an 80% grade on that, and that's a pass, so you did great.
It's a B minus, so that's where I stand.
Yeah. So, I guess that concludes another show for this week. We hope you enjoyed our deep analysis of It and Ernest Scared Stupid. It was quite an interesting comparison. For Joel LaPuma, I'm Chris Jordan. Thank you for joining us. And as always, stay tuned for the next episode. We will see you next time.